Well, we're going to turn now to the book of Ruth, one of the most moving stories in the whole of the biblical canon, I think. Many people think it shows such sensitivity in its composition that it must have been written by a woman. Well, if it was, maybe it was the wife of the guy who wrote the book of Judges, because there's certainly a lot of theological connection between the two books. I'd like to read the first chapter. I think it's good to read some of the text of the books we're looking at in a more coherent way, and may remind us of just what a beautifully told story this is. So let me read to you the first chapter. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. And a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. The man's name was Elimelech, his wife's name Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem, Judah, and they went to Moab and lived there. Now Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. They married Moabite women, one named Orpah and the other Ruth. After they had lived there about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and Naomi was left without her two sons and her husband. When she heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people by providing food for them, Naomi and her daughters-in-law prepared to return home from there. With her two daughters-in-law, she left the place where she had been living and set out on the road that would take them back to the land of Judah. Then Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go back, each of you, to your mother's home. May the Lord show kindness to you, as you have shown to your dead and to me. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband." Then she kissed them, and they wept aloud and said to her, "We will go back with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Return home, my daughters. Why would you come with me? Am I going to have any more sons who could become your husbands? Return home, my daughters. I am too old to have another husband. Even if I thought there was still hope for me, even if I had a husband tonight and then gave birth to sons, would you wait until they grew up? Would you remain unmarried for them? No, my daughters. It is more bitter for me than for you, because the Lord's hand has gone out against me." At this they wept again. Then Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. "Look," said Naomi, "your sister-in-law is going back to her people and her gods. Go back with her." But Ruth replied, "Don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go, and where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if anything but death separates you and me." When Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. So the two women went on until they came to Bethlehem. When they arrived in Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them, and the women exclaimed, "Can this be Naomi?" "Don't call me Naomi," she told them. "Call me Mara, because the Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi? The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me." So Naomi returned from Moab, accompanied by Ruth, the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law. Arriving in Bethlehem as the barley harvest was beginning. There's a hole in the world now. In the place where he was, there's now just nothing. Only a gap remains. There's nobody now who saw just what he saw, knows what he knew, remembers what he remembered, loves what he loved. A person, an irreplaceable person, has gone. Questions I have can never now get answers. The world is emptier. My son is gone. Only a hole remains, a void, a gap never to be filled. Nicholas Wolterstorff teaches philosophy at Yale, and in June 1983, his 25-year-old son Eric died in a climbing accident in the Alps. In his book, Lament for a Son, which is well worth getting hold of, Professor Wolterstorff tries to trace the personal anguish of his loss as he struggled to come to terms with it. Some of you here, I imagine, have traveled that path too. Maybe some of you are even traveling it as I speak. And if so, you will know the stages of grief that he chronicles in his book. The numbness of the early days, which others so often mistake for strength. The deep sadness that engulfs the spirit once that initial shock wears off, drowning it in wave upon wave of melancholy and depression. The irrational feelings of guilt and anger that surprise and bewilder the mourner. The strange struggle between fantasy and reality, the tormenting expectation that he will at some moment come through the door and everything will be back as it was before again. And the ache that finds no relief, the questions that find no answers, the regret, the yearning for just one more opportunity to say sorry, to say thank you, maybe just to say goodbye. And the utter sense of isolation, that private hell which is so exasperated by well-intentioned but wholly inadequate platitudes, often from well-meaning Christians. You'll get over it, they say, when you're screaming for someone to articulate just how appallingly grim it feels. You have your memories, they say, but you don't want memories. Memories are just dust and ashes in your mouth. Memories are just the trigger for fresh pain. A phrase of music, a fragrance in the air, a passing likeness in the crowd, such insignificant and unplanned souvenirs. Yet they're more than sufficient to plunge the soul down fresh cataracts of despair. There's a hole in the world now, a void, a gap, never to be filled, writes Wolterstorff. And that hole passes, of course, for those who've loved right through the heart. Well, as I say, if you have journeyed that path of grief, you're going to have no problem in engaging emotionally with the story of Ruth. For it, too, is the story of bereavement. Women thrown into a situation of utter hopelessness and despair by the death of their loved ones. The opening lines set the stage in history for this domestic tragedy. In the days when the judges ruled. Well, we know from our earlier studies what our narrator intends us to conclude from that. What any Jewish reader would conclude from that. The judges was the time when there was no law in Israel. When everyone did as he pleased. The book of Judges was the time when young innocent girls got raped on city streets and left for dead on doorsteps. And that in Bethlehem. It would have been a tough enough period at the best of times in that day, but you'll notice that to the violence and the criminality of that period, our narrator adds a second burden, a cruelty of providence this time. Not only was it the day when the judges ruled, there was famine in the land. Was this a judgment from God upon the people's moral degeneracy? Was it perhaps, as sometimes it has been in the Horn of Africa in recent years, a famine exacerbated by their incessant warmongering? I suspect our narrator may intend us to draw some such inference, because, as I say, it is Bethlehem which is the setting for his story, and Bethlehem was the very place from which that gang rape of Judges 19 emerges. It's ironic too, of course, because the word Bethlehem means the house of bread. There was no bread then in the house of bread. Is it any wonder, in a place where sexual brutality and mob violence had become commonplace? Still, Bethlehem was at least, as our narrator records, a city of Judah. That is, it lay within the boundaries of the promised land, the land which God had given to his chosen people. So once again, one can't help, I think, but detect at least the suspicion that Elimelech's decision to forsake Bethlehem as an economic refugee and go to Moab was ill-judged. Moab, after all, was hardly the place where any self-respecting Jew would choose to live. They were idolatrous pagans in Moab and had made no secret of their enmity towards Israel over preceding centuries. In fact, the law of God, Deuteronomy, said, "No Moabite shall enter the Lord's assembly." True, it wasn't strictly speaking illegal, contrary to the terms of God's covenant law, for Elimelech to move his family to Moab in time of famine, but it was certainly no act of great faith either, especially since he took with him his two presumably teenage sons. What chance was there in Moab that they would find Jewish girls to date? Is it any surprise that we discover Mahlon and Cillian eventually announced their intention to marry two local Moabite women? Now, I think we conclude that, like so many at the time of the judges, Elimelech sat pretty loose to the religion of his forefathers. He was not, I suspect, downright apostate, but he was, to say the least, very far short of being a spiritual hearer. And as if to confirm our suspicion in this regard, the narrator goes on to record not only his premature death, but also the premature death of his two sons as well. Once again, against an Old Testament Jewish background, the narrator, I think, leaves room for us to surmise that maybe this too was some act of divine retribution. Anyway, with the men untimely removed, the stage is cleared for what to Jewish ears must have been a rather unexpected and novel twist in the story. Unlike so many of those militaristic adventures that we read about in the book of Judges surrounding this period of time, this tale will be all about women. Women, what's more, who demonstrate a good deal more spirituality in their little finger than most of the men in the whole book of that period of the book of Judges seem to have had in their whole bodies. Look first at Naomi, Elimelech's widow, verses 6 to 7. When she heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people by providing food for them, Naomi and her daughters-in-law prepared to return home from there. With her two daughters-in-law, she left the place where she'd been living and set out on the road that would take them back to the land of Judah. Had she been a reluctant emigre in the first place, perhaps? At the very least, she is keen to get back to Judah.
At the very least, the death of her husband and sons has resulted in the rediscovery of her spiritual roots. She heard that the Lord had provided food for them. That's the way she sees it. Moab had been a bit of a disaster. She'd lost everything, not even a grandchild to show for it all. It's time to go back. Let's try to pretend these 10 years have never happened. Let's try to salvage something out of the appalling misery of it all, she says. But then a thought occurs to her. Verse 8. Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go back, each of you, to your mother's home. May the Lord show kindness to you as you have shown to your dead and to me." When they married into Elimelech's family, technically Ruth and Orpah became part of that family. There was no longer any link, any legal link back to their parental families as daughters. But in this situation, this rather unusual situation, Naomi sees that their best interests are served by a return to their parental families in Moab. So many commentators interpret her words here as a gesture of rather exceptional generosity in the face of profound personal grief. For Naomi is certainly volunteering to bid farewell to the only remaining social support she has left in her widowed state. We have no idea what kind of extended family may have been back in Bethlehem waiting for her return. But now that she was elderly, it could not have been that much. It does say, I think, rather a lot for Naomi's character that her daughters-in-law are so reluctant to take advantage of this offer. "No," they tell her in verse 9, "we will go back with you to your people." But Naomi says, "Return home, my daughters. Why would you come with me?" Perhaps in part it was their solidarity in grief that had drawn them together. But one has to say bereavement doesn't always have that effect on people, does it? We grieve in different ways. And those of you who are pastors will know that sometimes the experience of loss has the effect of distancing us from family members rather than drawing us closer to them. In any case, the relationship between a mother-in-law and her son's wives is not renowned for its easy affection, is it? Now, I think Naomi must have been, at least in the days before her husband's death, a woman of great kindness and affection, amply living up to her name. Naomi means, of course, pleasant. And her suggestion that Ruth and Orpah should return home was no doubt just one more expression of a graciousness that they had come to expect of her. But I can't help suspecting our narrator wants us to catch an ironic, perhaps even sarcastic edge to her tone in verse 8. When she says, "May the Lord show kindness to you as you have shown to your dead and to me." As if one could detect the unspoken implication, God, frankly, could take a lesson from you two. Pagans though you are, you've shown a great deal more kindness to me than he has. I just hope he treats you better than he's treated me, that's all. For he has left me without rest, without a home, without a husband to my name, and no prospect of ever finding such security or peace of mind again. How does he put it in verse 11 and following? "It is more bitter for me than for you. The Lord's hand has gone out against me." See what I mean when I say there is perhaps a streak of cynicism there alongside her generosity? As if to say, "Don't stick with me, I'm a loser, I'm a jinx. Things will only get worse for you if you stick with me. After all, what are you, young Moabite women? Back where I come from, you'll be victim to all kinds of racial discrimination and sexual harassment. I know what it's like in Bethlehem these days. It's not a safe place for a woman to walk alone at night. Your only hope of survival in that jungle is if you've got a husband to protect you and to provide for you. But what hope is there of that for you? What self-respecting Jew is going to take one of that despised Moabite race to wife in their own country? My boys only did it because they were living in Moab. They'd never have done it at home. Maybe if I had more sons, they would do the decent thing and marry you in their brother's place. But I have none. Nor any prospect of getting any. And even if I did, you'd be past marriageable age by the time they were grown up. It's ridiculous. It's pointless you coming back with me. You'll only increase your store of bad luck. The only hope you have is in Moab. In Judah, there's no hope for any of us. Least of all for me. No, my daughters, it is more bitter for you, for me, than for you, because the Lord's hand has gone out against me. Maybe then those commentators are right who suggest it was not so much heroic generosity on Naomi's part as resigned despair that moved her to offer these two women the freedom to return to their Moabite homeland. A hopelessness so abject in its grief that it has become almost masochistic in the intensity of its self-pity. Certainly there does seem to be that mood about the way she greets the women of Bethlehem when she eventually gets back there in verse 20, doesn't there? "Don't call me Naomi," she tells them. "Call me Mara," that is, bitter, "because the Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why do you call me Naomi? The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me." It's as if coming back to Bethlehem with all its old memories brings out the full force of the anger of this grief-stricken woman. One translator has tried to anglicize the pun very poorly. "Don't call me sweetheart, call me sour puss." But this is how grief takes us human beings. Beyond the range of hope, she is plunged into depths of uncharacteristic melancholy. Professor Walterstaff again. "I have become an alien in the world," he writes. "Shyly I touch the world as if it were no longer mine. I don't belong here anymore. The lines of memory all lead now into a place of cold and inky blackness. I buried myself that warm June day. It was me those gardeners lowered on squeaking straps into that hot, dry hole. It was me over whom they slid that heavy slab. It was me on whom they shoveled the dust. It was me we left behind. Sometimes I think I shall never be happy again." What do we learn from a story like this? The first thing we have to learn is a lesson about grieving. Some commentators, recognizing the negative mood of Naomi's dialogue in this chapter, are disposed to criticize her. "After all," they say, "Ruth was grieving too. But she seems to have found a much more positive frame of mind than her mother-in-law. So surely the author intends to disparage Naomi's bleak despair, intends us to draw a favorable comparison, that Ruth was different. It certainly can't be right to hurl blame upon God in the way Naomi does so repeatedly in verse 13 and 20 and 21. But personally, I doubt very much that the narrator intends us to read his words, or Naomi's words, in that way, or to respond in that critical fashion. I suspect, rather like the book of Job, rather like so many of the Psalms, our author here is simply encouraging us to empathize with the emotional devastation which bereavement brings in its wake. Of course Naomi blames God. Many grief-stricken souls do blame God. And it's easy to see why. Is he not the sovereign ruler of all human affairs? Are life and death not his gift? If he didn't take Elimelech and her two sons away from her, who did? There's no impiety in that kind of emotional honesty. Indeed, I suspect God is in this story by its very narrative force, inviting us to be real about our own feelings in similar circumstances. All characterization in story is an invitation to identify with the character. And for some, identification that is with Naomi. If we have any doubts about the Bible's willingness for us to identify with that kind of anger, even anger directed against God in situations of loss and loneliness, we do well to remember the one who in his hour of grief cried out in identification with suffering innocents the world over, my God, why have you forsaken me? When we are bewildered by God's dealings with us, when we feel cheated by the cruelty of his providence, then it is natural. It's certainly not unspiritual to want to tell him so. And bottling up our rage in that situation is likely to have only the effect of intensifying our depression. You know, as a pastor, you so often hear people say, don't you, I know I shouldn't feel like this. Frankly, I don't think should is a very helpful word in the context of our emotional lives. Because our feelings are not under the control of our wills in the same way that our moral actions are. To be ashamed of your feelings is a bit like being ashamed of your appearance. There's only a limited amount you can do to change the way you look. And there's only a limited amount you can do to change the way you feel. The appropriate response to negative feelings is the same as an appropriate response to that pimple that you wish wasn't on your face. Acceptance, not guilt. If we refuse to face up to our feelings, our negative feelings, we are very likely to condemn ourselves to an even more vicious cycle of accumulated inner grievance from which we will find no easy escape. Some of you may have heard me tell before an incident from Peter de Vries' novel, The Blood of the Lamb, had a very powerful effect on me many years ago when my daughter for a while was seriously ill. It's the story of a man who also has a daughter who is dying. She has leukemia. And the particular scene I have in mind is when the father is on the way to the hospital with a birthday cake. It is his daughter's 12th birthday, and he has the cake in his arms. And as he's on his way, he hears the news that she has died. He staggers from the gate to the hospital where he hears the news, around the street, still clutching this cake. And stumbles upon, as he's not sure where he's going, a church. A church with a crucifix embedded on the wall. Christ on the cross. And suddenly, as he looks up at the crucifix, he explodes with rage and hurls this birthday cake at the face of Christ. When I first read that, all my evangelical instincts came to my defense and told me it was an appalling, blasphemous act. And then I thought about it some more. And I realized, actually, it was nothing of the sort. It was a symbol of anger, true. But what is Jesus on the cross if he is not a symbol of anger? God's anger, the passionate anger of God against the evil of this broken and sinful world. That cross is the sign of that divine anger venting itself safely, healingly, in a gigantic catharsis of the divine passion. God reconciles himself to a sinful world in that cross. His anger is discharged there. How then could he possibly mind another father who has lost a child, venting his anger similarly? It is an unjust world, a tragic world we live in, a world that so often steals the ones we love best and who are most innocent. And when we feel angry, when, as in a situation of bereavement, we feel that providence has been cruel to us, we need to remember that God is no stranger to that emotion. He has felt it too. I don't believe he minds us expressing our anger. I think he knows we need to get such feelings off our chest if we are ever to be reconciled to what has happened, or to him, the architect of our lives. We should not blame others, because I don't believe he blames us for wallowing in a little self-pity at such times. All grief is self-pitying. We have lost somebody who was important to us. And even the knowledge that they are in a happier place and would not return to us if they could does not take the hole away that passes through the heart. Oh, Naomi's grief will not last forever. It's important we remember that. This story will have a happy ending. But while the grief does last, there is absolutely nothing in biblical religion that required Naomi to pretend she felt other than she did. And every encouragement in biblical religion for her to articulate her sorrow in God's presence just as it felt. I say we learn a lesson about grieving from Naomi. We evangelicals are not very good about being real with our emotions, are we? Yet in this scene of tragedy and brokenness, there is already a sign of hope. Unrecognized by Naomi, actually, at this stage in the story. For it comes from a most unexpected source. And it means we must look at the other leading lady of our plot, Ruth. Verse 14. Then Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye. But Ruth clung to her. Look, said Naomi, your sister-in-law is going back to her people and her gods. Go back with her. But Ruth replied, don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if anything but death separates you and me. Now, this decision on Ruth's part, though it occurs so early in the plot, is in fact the hinge upon which this whole story will turn. As events proceed, we shall discover that this decision is the turning point not only for the fate of Ruth and Naomi themselves, it is in fact the turning point for the entire nation of Israel. Indeed, it's not too much to say that God's entire plan of salvation for the whole world hinges on this apparently insignificant, minor decision of a Moabite widow. That's what makes this story extraordinary.
So why did she refuse to go home? Naomi certainly tried to persuade her to, but the force of her logic made not the slightest dent in Ruth's resolution. Verse 18, when Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her, or literally, she refrained from speaking to her. Once again, I suspect the tone of the Hebrew suggests not so much gratitude for Ruth's fidelity as the rather sullen, even exasperated silence of one whose ability to fight has been drained to zero by her emotional devastation. Naomi is beyond caring. She doesn't believe that Ruth's grand gesture is going to make any difference to her situation. As far as she's concerned, this is utter folly. And rationally speaking, Naomi is right to judge so. Ruth had every reason, every excuse, every justification for going back to her own familiar world, as her sister-in-law Orpah had chosen to do. It would be the sensible thing to do, the expected thing to do. Nobody could possibly blame her. Even her mother-in-law was saying so. Yet she opts to stay with Naomi, knowing that in all probability she is opting for a life of poverty, a life of celibacy, and a life of exile. Think about that. Have you ever lived in a foreign country? Do you know what it's like to be single all your life? Why did she make that choice? Well, the key for our author clearly lies in her own words, doesn't it? In verse 16 and 17. Look at them more carefully. Don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Now, what do those words imply? Well, at the very least, they imply that Ruth has clearly become a believer in the God of the Bible. She may be a Moabitess by race, but her faith has now become the faith of a Hebrew, not just nominally because she had married into a Jewish family, but for herself. She's being given the option to go back to her old gods, her tribal gods. She is making a personal decision not to do so. Clearly, then, this faith that she had embraced meant something personally to her. That, I think, has to be testimony to Naomi's godly example. It is very hard for me to believe that she had learned much about biblical religion that would have commended itself to her from her husband or her father-in-law. It has to have been this gracious lady Naomi who had made the impact on Ruth's life. Actually, there's a rather interesting double entendre in the way the narrator uses that verb, return, several times in this chapter, actually more times in the Hebrew than our translation suggests. Because, of course, the verb to return or to turn in Hebrew not only means to go back physically, it also carries the metaphorical sense of to repent or to convert. To turn to God, in other words. And it carries that force here for Ruth. For you see, Ruth is not returning to Bethlehem. She's never been there. And yet the Hebrew text of verse 22 distinctly says, both Naomi returned and Ruth returned. I can't help wondering if our author isn't exploiting that second metaphorical sense of the word there. Ruth's decision to accompany her mother-in-law to Bethlehem was a public identification with the God of Israel. It was, in a very real sense, a baptism. Your God will be my God. That desire not to identify any longer with the pagan idols of her own people was a major factor, it seems, in Ruth's choice. Yet there's more to it, I think, than even that. I want you to look at the form of Ruth's words here in verses 16 and 17. For they are not just a simple affirmation of resolution. Ruth quite deliberately casts her decision here in the form of a covenant promise. The invocation of a curse upon herself, should she break her word, is characteristic of such covenants in the ancient world. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if anything but death separates you and me. Such a form of words in the ancient world had the uncompromising force of a legal contract. Rather similar to a marriage vow today, for better or worse, till death us do part. Indeed, even more remarkable is the similarity between this form of words which Ruth chooses to use and the covenant promise which God had made to Israel at the time of Moses. God had said to Israel repeatedly in the earlier books of the Bible, "My presence will go with you. Wherever you go, my presence will go with you." And what does Ruth say to Naomi? "Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay." God had said to Israel again and again and again, "I will be your God and you will be my people." And what does Ruth say to Naomi? "Your people will be my people and your God will be my God." See, the parallels are conspicuous and surely deliberate. Why does Ruth do this? Why should she bind herself so irrevocably and so solemnly to this other woman in a form of words which was so characteristic of the divine covenant? And I think the conclusion our author is inviting us to draw is quite obvious. Ruth may have been a new believer in the God of Israel, but she had already learned that the primary moral response which the God of Israel demanded of his people was a covenant love. A covenant love like his own. The primary moral response that God demands of his people is a covenant love like his own. A covenant love evidenced not just by fidelity in our relationship to him, but also by fidelity in our relationships with one another. This, you see, was the very thing that was breaking down in this period when the judges ruled. Hosea, a few centuries later, would complain about it. There is no faithfulness, no covenant love, and no knowledge of God in the land. That's his analysis. No faithfulness, no covenant love, and no knowledge of God in the land. Instead, he says, there is only cursing and lying and murder and stealing and adultery. They break all bounds, and bloodshed follows bloodshed. And because of this, he says, because of this, the land mourns. And all who live in it waste away. He was describing 8th century Israel, but he could just as well have been describing 20th century Britain. Israel was sinking in a sea of moral anarchy, and at the root of that collapse was a collapse in the very ideal of covenant love in personal relationships. People didn't care about one another anymore. People didn't trust one another anymore. People weren't faithful to one another anymore. God had promised such covenant love to them, but Israel, for her part, in her rebelliousness, saw nothing to be gained by demonstrating such love towards one another. And she was reaping the judgment of God, you see, through her callous selfishness. The land mourns. There was no bread, even in the house of bread. And yet here, you see, in a private exchange between two apparently quite insignificant women, a different pattern of human relationships emerges. Ruth, the pagan convert, is showing a true-born Jewess the very kind of covenant love commitment God requires of his people when it comes to relationships. Orpah, her sister-in-law, was not a specially bad person for failing to demonstrate the same devotion to Naomi. She simply wasn't a believer. She couldn't take Ruth's step of faith. It was too sacrificial for her. She didn't believe in this God who rewarded covenant love. She didn't believe she should expect the hand of this covenant of God in her life to somehow deal with her. But Ruth did. And that's why Ruth chose the way she did. That's the lesson our author wants us to draw from this story, you see. When we human beings abandon love for God and neighbor, we make a desert around ourselves. A desert in which often the weak and the vulnerable, like Naomi, suffer most, even though they may be the least guilty. And yet, when just one individual discovers the faith to make costly sacrifice of themselves, that costly sacrifice which love for God and neighbor demands, then judgment begins to lift and the desert begins to blossom and despair begins to give way to hope. I say Ruth's decision to cling to Naomi is a watershed. A watershed which we know would eventually issue not just in the birth of King David, but in the birth of King Jesus. For Ruth is an honored ancestor of him too. Do you notice, even at this stage in the story, the little subtle hint which our author so cleverly inserts, that we are, at the end of Ruth chapter 1, standing on that watershed? So Naomi returned from Moab, accompanied by Ruth, the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, arriving where? In Bethlehem. When? As the barley harvest was beginning. So there is bread again in the house of bread. Well, well, well. And when do they start reaping it? Just as Ruth arrives. What a coincidence. So what are we to take away from this story? Well, we are to take away a lesson about grieving, sure. But we are to take away also a lesson about loving. We live in a world too, don't we, where human relationships are proving less than happy far too much of the time. Eric Fromm, in his book The Sane Society, observes, "There is not much love to be found in the world of today. There is rather a superficial friendliness, concealing a distance, an indifference, a subtle distrust." Karen Horney, in the book The Neurotic Personality of Our Time, writes, "The average individual today, even when he has many contacts with others and is happily married, nevertheless feels comparatively isolated. He is caught in the dilemma of hungering for a great deal of affection, and yet finds great difficulty in finding it." Nicholas Lash, in The Culture of Narcissism, "Our society has made lasting friendships, love affairs, and marriages increasingly difficult to achieve. Social life has become more and more warlike. Personal relationships have taken on the nature of combat. Some dignify the combat by offering courses in assertiveness training. Others celebrate the impermanent attachments that result with slogans like the open marriage. But in doing so, they merely intensify the dissatisfaction with the quality of human relationships, which lies at the heart of our problem. I don't know, phrases like superficial friendship and emotional isolation and pervasive dissatisfaction with the quality of relationships ring any bells with you. They certainly do with me. This is our world. And it is no surprise then that at the far end of that world, the statistics of rape and violence are becoming worse and worse. Or that ethnic tension and domestic violence and unease are growing the way they are growing. And is it any wonder, actually, against a biblical background, that we find our economic plight so vulnerable to cycles, to instability, to turmoil? For in a capitalist society, what is a stock market that doesn't know whether to go up and down? But there was famine in the land. The reason we have economic problems, the reason we have problems with crime, the reason we have such divorce rates, etc., that is not in our stars, but in ourselves. We are not the victims of fate. Such things are always the judicial chastening of God. There is no faithfulness, no covenant love, no knowledge of God in the land, and therefore the land mourns. The Bible says again and again and again that connection will be made in our experience. But the encouragement the story of Ruth brings is that you and I can do something about it. And we do not have to sit in Tony Blair's cabinet to do so. We do not have to walk the corridors of power to turn the tide for a whole society. What the Book of Ruth has the audacity to suggest is that a single act of heroic love on the part of an insignificant, ethnically alien widow woman was the key to the whole of Israel's future blessing. That is what it says. And it may be the same for us. This is why the world needs to see the way we Christians love each other. This is why the world needs to see the way we Christians love each other. There is nothing we can do for this sin-sick world of ours more powerful than, like Ruth, to demonstrate the nature of God's covenant love in our dealings with one another. I think this is a particularly poignant message for people here, or maybe people in our congregations back home, who are single. So many people do struggle, don't they, with the loneliness of being single. Often people resent it, whether they're divorced or bereaved or have remained single all their life. Like Naomi, they resent the way God has dealt with them deep down. It's understandable. Who wouldn't feel the same? But we do not have to wallow in self-pity, even as Naomi did not. There is an alternative response, though it requires great faith and sacrifice. And the story of Ruth illustrates it, doesn't it? There is a way out of bitterness into blessing. For Ruth made singleness not her fate, but her choice. She committed herself in covenant love, not to a husband, but to a widow. Her wifely devotion, her maternal energies, would at least for a period of time in her life be sublimated in serving and caring for a lonely, vulnerable person in desperate need of such support. She made that choice. Do you have any idea how many such lonely and vulnerable and desperate people there are right on the doorstep of this very church? We desperately need Ruths who are prepared to sacrifice their own desires and fulfillment for the sake of others. I think of a woman who has abandoned her career in order to care for an elderly relative with Alzheimer's. Is that not covenant love? I think of a man who has, I know, refused promotion in order to have more time to spend with his growing children. Is that not covenant love? I know a student who has surrendered his place on the first 11 in Cambridge on the sports field in order to take a handicapped child to McDonald's every Saturday afternoon. Is that not covenant love? I think of a nurse who has accepted probably lifelong singleness as the price of her calling to care for AIDS victims in Uganda. Is that not covenant love? I think of a couple who have accepted their own childlessness as an opportunity to foster the orphaned and the abused and the hurting children of a Liverpool suburb. Is that not covenant love? I think of a person I know who, in the press of an extremely busy and demanding life, makes space to be there reliably and instantly for their friends whenever they need them. Is that not covenant love? Don't let anybody tell you such things don't matter. Don't let anybody tell you such things don't count. We have it on the authority of our Master himself. Not a cup of water given to the least of these little ones will lose its reward. See? What you and I do in our world of personal relationships matters. And it matters on a scale far beyond our own petty lives. What to the eyes of unbelief seems like a pointless sacrifice, a histrionic gesture of no value or significance at all, in God's eyes may be a crucial event in his great cosmic plan. Ruth leaves the security of her homeland in order to care for an embittered old lady. So Christ leaves the glory of heaven to die lonely on a cross of wood. A futile sacrifice, a histrionic gesture? No. Upon such individual acts of moral heroism, the very destiny of our world is hinged. That is the faith of the Christian. It's that insight which every story in the Bible is trying to help us understand, and particularly this story of Ruth. It's not for nothing, he tells us then, to take up our cross and follow him. It's not for nothing, he says, my command to you is this: love each other as I have loved you. Let me take a few moments of quietness.